Welcome to this week's Investors Chronicle Personal Finance Podcast. I'm Lenora Walters, and joining me today are Tara Lokhandwala and Emma Adjiman, Deputy Personal Finance Editor and Personal Finance Writer at Investors Chronicle, and Michael Ingram, Global Market Strategist at WH Ireland. Defensive income shares and funds are supposed to fall less than the broader market in times of volatility, such as over the month of October. But over the first 3 months of this year, these kinds of assets fail to do this. Taha, first of all, why can certain types of income shares hold up better during falling markets?
Morning, Lenora. Well, the theory goes that this is based on their income. So they are long-term holders, that even in economic downturns or equity market falls, these are the kind of stocks that people still want to keep hold of. They kick off a bit of income, an income drawdown and stuff like that. So they work like that. They also tend to be not cyclical, defensive businesses, consumer-focused, consumer staple companies, things like that. And you can almost, they might get impacted by the share price, their revenue might fall slightly, but not as much as the kind of really economically sensitive growth stocks or kind of, you know, mining and oil and stuff like that. And they're also, they tend not to be growth stocks, then they're never the darlings of the previous bull market that kind of precedes a bear market. So therefore, they're not hit as hard because generally when things go sour, you look at what was doing well and that's where you take your money from, because that's whatever kind of force the previous bull market is probably what is going to have preceded the bear market, if that makes sense. So yeah, they are, as I said, staples, kind of software, healthcare, repeat businesses, cash generative, those kind of things.
So why did defensive income equities fail to mitigate downside at the start of this year?
So I looked into this and I spoke to a few analysts, and the reason being is that it was actually, at the start of the year, it was more of an unusual sell-off compared to what we saw in October. It was based on a kind of, it was more of a knee-jerk kind of sentiment-driven reaction to one piece of US economic data that made people think we were starting to go late cycle, but then everything that followed that basically disproved that sentiment. So it also seemed to be more of a valuation-driven sell-off as well, which again, as I mentioned, so things that were hit harder at the beginning of the year, like in January and February, were the kind of growth stocks, the tech stocks that have, you know, become seriously valued and things like that. But what also happened in Q1, which is kind of what defines why defensive stocks didn't do as well, is that while people were selling, people were buying back in. So actually, over the 3 months, growth stocks outperformed defensive stocks, because as much as there was kind of a lot of volatility, there was enough people who, after realizing the economic data wasn't as bad as they thought, were happy to put money back into the market. That didn't happen in October, so that's the major difference. That's why in October, defensive stocks actually outperformed.
You've done some research which also suggests that quality stocks aren't as defensive as they seem. Why is this?
So this is where it gets slightly confusing, and I go into this in the piece in this week's magazine. It actually comes down to the way in which you define defensive. So one way to find kind of defensive companies is by looking at the yield, because as I mentioned earlier, they're income stocks. They kick off a high yield. But what also is high yield are value stocks. That's a very common way to define what is a value company, because that's the depressed share price standard level of income. And this conflates the situation. So when you look at whether kind of high yield defensive stocks, as they can be known, actually outperformed, you have to break it down and see whether it was the quality companies that I kind of described or the value stocks, which are just depressed. And that's where it gets really confusing, because there are some arguments that suggest that value stocks can outperform in recessions. They can also outperform if a sell-off is valuation-driven, not macro-driven. And when you break it down into kind of Q1 in October, what actually happened in Q1 is that quality stocks outperformed and in October value stocks outperformed. So it's getting hard to pin down whether it was the quality characteristics that we know was doing the right thing, or whether it was just a value turn that we haven't quite picked up on, that hasn't become a long-term trend yet.
Okay, a bit confusing.
No, absolutely.
So on that note, what kind of income shares should you hold going ahead?
Again, this is there are two arguments to consider here. Generally, analysts will vote for the quality stocks, because they say that with quality stocks at the moment, is they have done so well over recent years that their valuation is a concern, and some people think that because they're valued so highly, they won't be defensive in a downturn. Analysts tend to disagree with that, saying that valuation doesn't matter as much in an economic downturn. It only matters over the long term. So if you're buying in for defensive characteristics, people will still do that and buy into the idea that a cash generative quality business will be a good place to be in a bear market. But then, as I said, if in the feature where I go into the arguments based on the value can outperform in a sell-off. There are even kind of models that show that value stocks can outperform in recessions, which is interesting when you consider that what we think about with value stocks tend to be the miners, oils, banks, very kind of economically sensitive businesses. But for some reason, there is data showing that they can do this quite well. And I suppose it kind of depends which line you fall on. For me, logically, it's quality stocks that make sense. But again, I'm open to ideas. I'm open to be proven wrong by other people's opinions here.
Okay, so what funds could you invest in to get exposure to these quality stocks?
So I've got a selection of funds here, two of which I think are focused on quality stocks. And then if anyone thinks that the value argument merits consideration, there's a value one as well. They will be common names to our listeners. Evenload Global Income is one that I've picked out. Again, it's a high yielding fund, but they actively seek out the quality businesses that I talked about. It's run by Ben Peters and Chris Elliott. Listeners might be aware of Evenload Income, which is the UK equity version of the same strategy, which has done very, very well recently. And the other defensive one is Troy Trojan Global Income. It's a bit of a mouthful. Run by James Harris. Again, Troy are very good at running strategies that are considered a bear market at all times. So they're very defensive and, again, buy these kind of quality businesses.
Okay. Michael, do you agree that funds which invest in defensive income shares are a good way to mitigate downside in falling markets?
Well, yes, in principle, but reliably identifying what actually constitutes, you know, defensive income is, as has already been indicated, is actually quite tricky. I think, you know, certainly two themes which are at the forefront of my thinking on this are, you know, structural change and cyclical exposure. Because, I mean, a lot of the areas that you'd say are natural homes for this style of investing have issues with one or both of those factors. So, for instance, you'd say, well, you know, defensive income, and you'd go to something like tobacco. But, you know, it's been a horrible performer, you know, this year. And only last night, you know, I saw a headline suggesting that the FDA in the United States are going to look at further restrictions on e-cigarettes. So, you know, that sector is not going to behave in this cycle, if we can even talk about cycles anymore, as it did previously. In a similar vein, you could look at, you know, telecommunications. I mean, that's not the sort of, you know, copper cable annuity business that it used to be. Again, not a great performer. I mean, look at the most, you know, recent example of a significant market drawdown, the month of October. Yeah. So FTSE All Share, I believe, was down 5.19% total return. Hope that's correct. You know, telcos are down 5%. You know, so not much defense there. And, you know, if you dig down and look at the usual suspects, shall we say, with the index heavyweights, it's sustainability of that dividend, which is the issue. And that's very much driven by the regulatory environment. It's driven by the needs to spend on things like 5G, you know, CapEx. You know, there are all sorts of things floating around here. So, you know, it's great to say, well, you know, these are the sectors, the dividend they appear to be offering is attractive. You know, if you look at the broader picture, again, perhaps not surprising that they're not performing as we might expect. And I would make a broader point on top of all of this is that I think it's very, very important to for analysts, when they're looking at these companies, looking at these sectors, to engage in some form of strategic analysis. So I think if you're sitting there as an analyst with your discounted cash flow valuation and whatever, they quite often are exercising in, I would say, naive extrapolation. And we all know that most of your valuation comes from the so-called, you know, terminal value, which bore everybody. You know, it's very, very sensitive to the assumptions that you make. And if you don't have an appreciation for where these various industries are going, because some of these industries are just being torn up, you don't have that reality check when you're putting your numbers in and your valuation and you're deciding whether to invest or not to invest in these stocks and these sectors.
Confusing picture.
It becomes a rubbish in, rubbish out.
What it comes down to, though, is, you know, bearing all that in mind, is one kind of income share better than another for defensive income, or can you just not define it like that?
Well, I think a natural conclusion from what I've just said is that, well, a particular issue, for instance, that the FTSE All Share has is just the sheer concentration of income. generation. And that's concentrated in a few stocks in a few sectors, most of whom, you know, you could say will have issues, you know, one way or the other. So, you know, the miners, you can go, well, you know, okay, they've been rehabilitated over the last few years, but, you know, who's to say that they won't go bonkers again and start buying everything as they did, you know, 15, 16 years ago? You know, banks, you know, how are they going to fare in a low interest rate environment, et cetera, et cetera. So I think what I was saying is that if you're looking for income, you probably will not get sufficient diversification by really playing, you know, a pseudo passive game. I think you're probably going to want to be a little bit more eclectic. I think you're probably going to have to want, you know, you're going to probably want to drill down a little bit further, maybe into sort of the more UK mid-cap space. But you've got to be very careful. I mean, all this is predicated, you know, on risk tolerances. You know, I've got to be very careful here. You know, but, you know, you've got to take it within a portfolio context. But, you know, what I would say is that, you know, quite often you'd say, well, income fund, you know, by definition, it's defensive. By definition, I invested in blue chip companies. Ergo, it's, you know, I think the riskiness of this fund and the performance of this fund will look like this. Well, guess what? You know, it's probably not going to be the case. But, you know, I think, you know, you need to do a bit more hard work, look at good companies which you know, maybe have idiosyncratic risk. Mm-hmm. And work well together as a portfolio. I mean, this is the important thing. Mm-hmm. You know, everybody gets very, very hung
what
up on single stock recommendations.
What do you own already and how does it marry with it? Yeah,
absolutely.
I mean, you talked about, you know, being open to looking at things perhaps like mid-caps. What would be the risks of these kind of shares, you know, mid-cap income shares?
Well, I mean, it tends to be things like liquidity risk. You know, and so I think the liquidity environment, liquidity risk is a key market theme going forward. Because again, you know, look what's happened post-financial crisis. You know, you have a situation where a lot of the, you know, the entities that used to put up capital, for instance, to facilitate trading during, shall we say, difficult market conditions, they're gone. You look at the bond market, you know, which is ultimately linked to what equities do. Quite often, a lot of equity price action is linked by the bond market. You know, I saw statistics that suggest that, you know, the primary dealers in the US bond market, their inventory is down by something like 96%. So which means that they can have a liquidity freeze, which has a knock on onto equity. And yeah, in that environment, all other things being equal, one might expect smaller caps to suffer more from a liquidity, or smaller caps to suffer from a liquidity drought, because liquidity is rationed.
Yeah. Okay. Bearing that in mind, are there any other assets you'd hold to mitigate downside in falling markets?
Well, again, this is quite thematically and all conditioned on, you know, risk tolerances and whatever. But I mean, you know, as I say, looking at non-correlated assets is key. I think, you know, again, just taking a step back yet again, the sort of 60-40 portfolio, you know, 60 equity, 40 fixed income, that is problematic from the perspective that, you know, whatever you think about the valuation of equities, it's quite easy to argue that a lot of fixed income universe, particularly in the UK, particularly in sort of, you know, sovereign space, gilts, etc., is even more expensive. So to expect that to offer an offset from equity market volatility is perhaps somewhat unreasonable. And yes, we did have some compensation in the most recent drawdown in October. But, you know, if you look at the sort of the lack of inflation compensation, for instance, embedded within UK gilts, is actually quite concerning. Anyway, to get to your question, so if I'm saying that large parts of the fixed income space aren't going to give you that sort of diversification and downside protection, you've got to look elsewhere. You've got to look at other non-correlated assets. Now, that's surprise, surprise. That's difficult because we've had 10 years of central banks bidding up public markets. But I mean, certain areas where you could look at sort of growth stories which are non-correlated, again, thematically, and again, this is all conditioned on, you know, risk tolerances, is things like, you know, renewables. Maybe you look at some structured products, though again, you've got to do a lot of due diligence there, because, you know, sometimes it's quite opaque as to how those returns are being generated and whether there are tail risks attached to that. You can look at things like maybe convertibles, because obviously convertibles have a volatility component, and volatility tends to be a kind of cyclical asset class, so markets go down, volatility goes up. So these are all sorts of areas, but, you know, sifting through all of that, and there's a lot of stuff. I mean, I could mention private equity. Again, I saw a survey by EY, I think, earlier this week, that suggested that whilst pension fund holders, so these are, you know, long-term investors, were scaling down on hedge fund hedge fund exposure. I think it was a net negative 9%. And let's be honest, hedge funds generally have struggled in the environment we've had over the last decade. I think it was a net positive 25% when looking at private equity. Yeah. So that's a hot button issue right now. But again, you know, we hear about the winners all the time. We hear about the Airbnbs and so forth all the time. We don't hear about the losers. The dispersion of returns within the private equity space is very, very high. So that's why, you know, really doing enormous amount of due diligence, trying to get as much transparency in as possible. But again, a lot of the themes in these, you know, whether it's listed or non-listed private equity, again, is liquidity.
Yeah.
Because even if they offer daily liquidity, you know, as we saw from the, you know, commercial real estate funds post UK referendum, well, yeah, they say they offer daily liquidity until they don't, and then you've got a problem.
Yeah. Now, on the subject of private equity, Scottish Mortgage Investment Trust mainly invests in global listed equities, but since 2010, it's also been investing in unquoted companies. The trust hasn't been disclosing how these holdings have been performing, but earlier this week, for the first time, it released performance figures. Emma, how have Scottish Mortgage Investment Trusts unquoted investments been performing?
Basically very well, Leonora. So unquoted investments made a return of almost 420%, and that's between June 2010, when the trust first started holding unquoted companies, and the 30th of September 2018. And just to give our listeners a sort of context, this trust benchmark, the FTSE All World Index, made 160% over that period. So that's 420% for its private assets portfolio compared to 160% for the benchmark.
Okay. Obviously, these are only one component of Scottish Mortgage Investment Trust. So how, you know, what's its overall return like?
Yeah, so over that period, the trust made a net asset value total return of 344%. So again, the private part of the portfolio did better than that. And in terms of the actual contribution that the private company's portfolio made to the trust overall, it was about 17%. That's counting when the companies remained unlisted. But if you actually look at companies that's actually subsequently listed, in total, the private part of the portfolio made 30% in terms of overall contribution to the trust.
Okay, so not majority. What percentage of Scottish Mortgage Investment Trust assets do unquoted account for?
Yeah, I mean, it's a good question. Basically, at the moment, the trust has about 15% of its portfolio in unquoted, and overall it has 80 holdings, and so 37 of them are in unlisted companies. It can actually have up to a quarter of its assets in unlisted companies, so it actually does have some room for manoeuvre if it wants to increase that.
Okay. Now, have any of these unquoted holdings in particular made a strong contribution?
Yeah, definitely. One I'll talk about is Chinese tech firm Alibaba. So the trust bought this company when it was an unquoted company in 2012, and it listed in September 2014, at which point the return that the trust had made was 270%. But they continue to hold the Alibaba, and subsequently, as of September, they've made a total return of more than 1,000%. So that's a pretty, you know, whopping return there.
Okay. Now, which of its unquoted holdings haven't done so well?
Well, I mean, I think it's interesting. It's important to kind of raise this point, because the managers actually say that the private part of the portfolio so far has actually been performing very, very strongly. But overall, it's still early days, and people need to think that some of these companies won't do well. And a couple of examples are two recently listed German companies that the trust bought when they were unlisted. One is called HelloFresh, and it delivers meal kits sort of at home. And there's an online furniture retailer, Home24. Both of those, so far, in the last year or so that they've been listed, they've been on the stock market, haven't performed particularly strongly.
Okay. Now, Michael, Scottish Mortgage Investment Trust and Quoted Investments have overall done very well. And you also mentioned that private equity could be a portfolio diversifier, perhaps to help mitigate downside. But that said, you know, what are the risks of investing in unquoted companies, private equity?
Well, there are multiple risks, and I think I've touched on some of them. So one is that, you know, you're generally talking about very early stage companies, and there's a very high degree of execution risk. And, you know, sometimes you'll get a, you know, the next Alibaba, and sometimes you'll get, you know, petsfood.com, which I don't think that ceased to exist many, many years ago. You know, there isn't a great deal of, you know, transparency as to the valuation. And obviously, you know, once they list, you've got a market valuation, but until then, you've got, you know, maybe a relatively few number of bilateral transactions where you just, you know, where the data is taken from. Liquidity, I've mentioned, obviously, it's, you know, your ability to trade out, particularly if you want to trade out in the down market, there could be effectively no bid out there. You know, these entities tend to be leveraged. I mean, look, there's a lot, there are layers of risk there. And of course, you know, the other thing, of course, and this goes, I guess, for any fund that you might be looking to invest in, is you've got to trust the managers actually knows what they're doing when they're looking at these opportunities. It's very, very easy to come out sort of starry-eyed out of a slick presentation, but, you know, they need to be a bit more circumspect before signing any checks.
Yeah, I mean, in view of that, then, if, you know, you know a fund, for example, like Scottish Mortgage Investment Trust, has this allocation to these risky unquoted companies as well as equities, you know, should you invest in it or should you avoid it?
Right. Well, I'm coming perilously close to being asked to make an investment recommendation.
Not specifically about Scottish mortgage.
Well, look,
generally,
I mean,
about funds, let's say mixed asset funds that include private equity. Are they a good idea?
I mean, private equity is for very risk-seeking clients. I mean, there's very little doubt.
What about a fund that has maybe 15% or 10% in it, but, you know, isn't 100% committed to private equity? Is a mixed asset fund a good idea?
Well, I mean, again, in principle, but you have to take it in context of a, you know, a broader portfolio. So if your only holding was Scottish Mortgage, you could say, well, OK, it's only 15%. You know, obviously, if it went 20, 25%, they could do that, then you'd have to say, well, all other things being equal, that fund is becoming riskier and it may or may not be suitable for your investment needs anymore. I mean, the important thing always with these things is to seek advice, to seek professional advice, because, you know, I might think I'm a high risk investor or a medium risk investor, but there's no way I can actually calibrate that. So you need somebody professionally saying, well, you think you're conservative, but actually you're not, or you think you're, you know, because so you've got to be very, very careful in this. So I say, look, I think in certain funds with certain risk tolerances, it's a useful component. What I would say is if hypothetically Scottish Mortgage were part of a broader portfolio, we have to recognise the fact that private equity is in there. You are exposed to that. And so if there was a certain risk tolerance, then we would have, you know, as investment managers, we would have to take measures elsewhere to mitigate that increase in risk profile. It's always, you know, again, it's think beyond the label, think about what you're actually buying, because the label sometimes doesn't tell you a great deal about what you're buying. You need to have a granular view of what your underlying exposure is.
Okay. Now, there's obviously also funds that are 100% in private equity, private equity investment trusts. Are these a good idea, perhaps, for investors who have a high risk appetite?
Potentially. I mean, you know, I have to be consistent with what I already said. But I mean, yeah, it is high octane stuff. I mean, there's no way of getting past it. And again, you know, it's not even just about appetite for risk. It's appetite, it's ability to wear significant drawdowns, not having any access to your money, potentially, for years. You know, it's no surprise that a lot of the private equity space, both quoted and unquoted, is occupied by, you know, very high net worth individuals or institutions, because they have very large balance sheets and they can take a 10-year view.
Yeah.
You know, they don't need 4% or 6% a year to fund their golf membership and their holiday abroad. And to make it something somewhat more topical, I mean, just to notice that, you know, Goldman Sachs has, you know, announced, you know, new partners, a new sort of class of partners. And they said, well, some of the benefits other than, you know, big pay packet is, you know, an opportunity to, you know, participate in exclusive investments. Well, what do you think those are? Well, you know, they're a lot of it, that's going to be private equity stuff that, you know, us mere mortals don't get to see very often.
Okay. Now, Scottish Mortgage Investment Trust recently published its half-year results to the 30th of September. So, Emma, private equity aside, how did it do overall?
Well, it just continued to do very well, basically. Over the half year to the 30th of September, its share price has risen 22%. And its NAV was, you know, not far behind at 19%, both of which beat the FTSE All World Index, which made 11%. So, yeah, it's still doing very well.
OK. I mean, it's had a really good run for quite a few years. But can this continue?
Yeah, I think it's a really important question. I mean, there are arguments for and against. So on the plus side, the trust has a very good portfolio of stocks. As we're saying, potentially, if some of its private assets continue to do well, it could give it a big boost. And the managers are very experienced. You know, they've shown a good track record of being able to choose good companies. But on the other hand, its growth-focused style has been very much in favour for the last 10 years. And as we saw recently with the sell-off in US tech stocks that happened in October, this trust was very hurt by that because it's got such a large exposure in this area. And if the market were to rotate towards more value-focused companies, it could suffer. So, yeah, it's one to wait and see what happens, really.
Okay. Michael, as Emma just said, a reason for Scottish Mortgage Investment Trust's recent volatility was its exposure to growth-orientated tech stocks. So just turning to these more widely, do you think there's more trouble ahead for tech stocks and should investors avoid funds of substantial weightings to them?
It's a tricky one. There's certainly going to be more volatility ahead. I mean, but I think that's also true of the broader market. Well, what I can say is if you look at the sort of numbers, the sort of earnings and so forth, that as the sector as a whole, and I accept it's not a homogenous sector, they actually haven't done too badly at all, despite some, you know, headlines and Apple's numbers for the Q4 disappointed the market, for instance. But, you know, as a whole, they weren't too bad. And you're not really seeing analysts pare back their estimates for either the full year 2018 and 2019. So, you know, the growth at least seems to be there. How the market prices that growth, of course, is another matter. And to distinguish between what happened in February, March, in terms of the broader market downturn, and what happened in October, they were distinctly different. And I think something which perhaps hasn't been, you know, touched upon at this point is that in February, March, it was a risk-free pricing, whereas there are clear worries about growth going forward that were behind the October volatility. And, you know, one would have thought that actually if in a world where there's less growth, then the market pays up for growth. Generally, it's because growth is scarce, yeah? So anyway, I'm going a little bit roundabout. I think so what I'm saying is if you look at it bottom up, if you look at it at the company level, they're largely delivering. And there's clearly an opportunity there. There's always execution risk. I think the biggest risk at the moment is actually legislative or stroke political, actually, because one of the things behind the wobble in tech earlier in this year when we had, you know, Mark Zuckerberg and so forth hauled up in front of the Senate, and one of the areas that we might actually get some bipartisan support, you know, a few question marks on this one, but post the US midterms, is tighter regulation of the sector in terms of taxation, in terms of treatment of client data. And obviously the EU is way ahead of the US in this regard. And that really would very well be a danger, because to some extent the game that many of these tech companies have been playing is effectively a form of regulatory arbitrage.
Yeah. I mean, on that note, as you said, earlier this week there was an election. How has this affected US markets so far, and what could be the implications going ahead?
Well, on the day, we definitely had a very positive reaction, and that spilled over to global markets, and we saw it here in the UK. And I actually wrote a short piece just before the election to say that actually the consensus result, and bearing in mind how wrong pollsters have been, you know, it wasn't a complete shoo-in, but the consensus view was that the Democrats would take the House of Representatives and the Republicans would retain control of the Senate. So, you know, effectively it's a recipe for gridlock, particularly how partisan politics are. And the bottom line really is that very little significant legislation was going to be able to be passed for the remainder of Trump's term, so the next 2 years. Now, this in some respect might actually be an optimal outcome for investors given the alternatives. So, for instance, the lack of control for the Republicans takes a second tax cut probably off the table for America for the foreseeable future. And one of the things that the Federal Reserve, the US Central Bank, have been worried about is the fact that the US is already running what we call a very pro-cyclical, you know, fiscal policy. It's the most expansionary relative to the cycle since the Vietnam War. And obviously that's likely to stoke inflation. And that's one of the reasons why I think the Fed has been rather more aggressive with interest rates. And you know, to bring it up sort of pretty much up to date, you know, it's one of the reasons why the markets last night were somewhat disappointed to hear that the Fed was actually probably going to go ahead and raise rates again one more time in December. They thought they might take the foot off the gas. The other thing, of course, is the budget deficit, which, you know, will have implications, broader implications for the dollar, because it's, you know, you would have thought with the extra, you know, interest rates you're getting in the US now over certainly Europe and the UK, that the dollar would be a lot stronger, and the thing holding it back is a budget deficit. Now, to go back to sectors, you know, we can look at things like pharmaceuticals, which I think is probably the one which has been most cited. I think that, again, there might be some scope for bipartisan support for lower drug prices. It's something that Trump campaigned on. They've only nibbled away at it.
Just to get back to the main issue, should investors buy, hold or sell US equities at the moment?
Well, I think from a portfolio construction basis, it depends on how you benchmark. It depends how you benchmark. And, you know, it's always very tempting to say, well, look, I'm a UK investor. I have UK liabilities. I need to generate a sterling income. What I would say is, US specific, it's a broader issue, is that over the longer term, international diversification has paid off.
Mm.
It has paid off. And a lot of that diversification has actually come through the currency exposure. And thematically, the UK is a relatively defensive market and it's a relatively low growth market. So if you are 100% UK, you are constrained by that. And if depending on your risk tolerances, that might be perfectly appropriate. But if you're looking for something which is a bit higher growth, maybe a bit riskier, and obviously that risk tends to, over the longer term, tends to be, you know, ameliorated, then that's fine. And also, you know, I point out, and this to some extent comes back to the private equity theme that we've been following, is there are opportunities in the US which you're just not going to get anywhere else. You know, I once joked that,
Would you say that US equities are too expensive? Because, right, they offer growth and there's certainly sectors that you can't really get exposure to the UK market, but arguably they're very expensive at the moment.
Arguably,
so
yes.
Should you diversify perhaps another foreign market, or should you, you know, include some exposure to the US?
Well, if you look at the All World Index, I mean, it's over 50% US. So, you know, it may or may not be the right call, you know, in retrospect. But, you know, that is where the market, it's the tyranny of indexation, I'm afraid. I think one issue that certainly has to be addressed is, you know, you get this sort of thing going growth at reasonable price as an investment style. But it's very difficult through this sort of mission creep thing for growth at reasonable price to become growth at any price. And you pay a massive premium for growth. And what we've seen is this massive polarization between growth and value. And it was mentioned earlier that, you know, you've seen growth outperform value for 10 years. I think it's closer to 20, actually. And actually, you have seen a bit of a rally of value styles over growth over the last 2 or 3 months, and you know, in particularly a bit of a pickup in October. But we've had these sort of thing, you know, false dawns before. We had it in the last quarter of 2016, you know, and then, you know, what happened in 2017, and you know, and tech hasn't performed badly this year either, actually. So, but I think it is a worry. I think that. You know, there are other causes behind it. I think, you know, the way that the market is invested in via things like ETFs is helping to distort that polarization in valuation, and how that works its way out of the system. I think that's a problem, particularly if it comes at the same time of a market liquidity shock.
Okay, thank you, Michael. Some really useful points. That brings us to the end of today's show, but you can read more on defensive income, Scottish Mortgage Investment Trust, and unquoted companies in this week's issue of Investors Chronicle on the website. Thank you for listening, and have a good weekend.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.